Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you're tracking global economic trends, you know that the way the world currently works, how we source, manufacture, and then just dispose of stuff, is fundamentally broken. It's a runaway train of extraction.
That's absolutely the headline issue. We're talking about the traditional linear business model, you know, the take-make-waste pathway.
Right.
And while it delivered enormous growth over the last century, it's extractive by its very design. It achieves short-term profits by offloading these huge long-term costs onto society and the environment.
Things like resource depletion, ever-increasing pollution, massive waste accumulation.
Exactly. And the consensus across the research, and certainly in the material we looked at for this, is that this pathway is not just ethically tricky, it's becoming economically unviable.
It's a ticking clock.
It is. That's the key realization. I mean, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the pressures are just mounting from every direction.
You have a growing global population driving up consumption.
Right. And at the same time, the rising costs of environmental damage and the instability that comes from relying entirely on finite natural resources. Companies that stay strictly linear are taking on a strategic risk they won't be able to manage in 5 or 10 years.
So we need a complete system overhaul. And that brings us to our focus today. Circular business models, or CBMs. We're going to map out exactly what they are, the core principles guiding them, and most critically, the 5 distinct strategic types of CBMs that companies are using right now.
CBMs are really about changing the goalposts. They're these sophisticated strategic frameworks designed for businesses to actively minimize their environmental impact while, and this is crucial, maintaining or even enhancing their economic performance.
So it's not a compromise. It's a total redesign.
It's a redesign. It requires a whole new way of thinking about the product itself.
How so?
Well, they operate on the principle of keeping resources in circulation for as long as possible. CBMs influence every single stage of the business cycle. They force you to rethink sourcing, production, distribution, and even the fundamental design of the product from day one.
So you're accounting for resource recovery and waste prevention from the moment of conception.
From the very beginning, the whole idea is to design waste out of the system.
And our sources highlight 4 core principles for that. First, just reducing the overall resource volume you need. Then, reusing existing materials in their current form, repairing and maintaining products to maximize their life, and finally, recycling materials back into new production.
And this shift isn't really optional anymore. It's driven by global necessity. It aligns companies with climate commitments, it mitigates resource scarcity risks, and it responds directly to growing pressure from stakeholders, from shareholders to consumers.
Right. Everyone is demanding more responsible operation now.
They are. CBMs are the practical way to deliver on those corporate social responsibility goals.
Okay, so let's unpack this and get into the real tactical strategies. If a company wants to transition from linear to circular, where do they even start? The material we looked at lays out 5 distinct models.
That's right. And we can start at the very front end, the raw materials, with what's called the circular supply model.
This one focuses entirely on the input stage, right? Moving away from extraction.
Exactly. The core mechanism is shifting your sourcing away from virgin, finite raw materials. So your inputs have to be renewable or recycled or biodegradable.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. A great one is seeing major apparel brands phasing out virgin polyester and sourcing exclusively from recycled plastic bottles.
Okay.
Or using plant-based fibers that can naturally degrade.
Okay, but what's the concrete business advantage here beyond the environmental win? Is it just about public image?
Not at all. I mean, that helps, but the long-term advantage is profound supply chain resilience.
Now so.
Well, if you reduce your dependency on volatile global commodity markets for scarce resources, think oil, certain rare earth minerals, you stabilize your input costs dramatically.
It's a strategy for risk mitigation.
A huge one. You're creating a closed loop that you can control, rather than being constantly exposed to geopolitical instability or wild price swings.
So we've secured our inputs. But what about the material that has been used? Or the waste stream that's, you know, an inevitable part of any process? That's where we get the resource recovery model, isn't it?
Yes. This is where waste stops being a liability and starts being treated as a valuable asset. This model is all about converting discarded materials back into usable inputs for new cycles.
And that, of course, massively minimizes the burden from landfills and more extraction.
Right. And within this framework, we see some really fascinating, highly technical approaches.
Okay. Can you break those down for us?
Certainly. There are about 3 main tactics here. The most philosophical one is cradle-to-cradle design, or C2C.
Cradle-to-cradle.
Yeah, it means creating products with the end-of-life stage explicitly in mind, ensuring materials can either be safely returned to the biosphere as nutrients or recovered easily for technical cycles. It genuinely imitates natural systems where nothing is wasted.
So you're designing a product to be disassembled, not just trashed.
Precisely. Then you have closed-loop recycling, which is the one we're probably most familiar with, collecting and remanufacturing waste into new products.
Like with metals, textiles, electronics?
Exactly. But the most intriguing one, I think, is industrial symbiosis.
That sounds a bit academic. What does industrial symbiosis look like in the real world?
It's cross-industry collaboration at its best. The idea is that one company's waste or byproduct becomes another company's raw material.
So they create these localized, interconnected ecosystems.
They do. The classic, powerful example is the industrial park in Kalundborg, Denmark. They've been doing this for decades. A local power plant's waste heat and steam are piped directly to a fish farm, to nearby homes for heating, and to a pharmaceutical company. And the fly ash from the power plant. It's used by a cement manufacturer. They turned polluting byproducts into shared assets.
That's an incredible illustration of how circularity moves beyond just one company's walls. Okay, let's look at the product itself, which brings us to model number 3, product life extension models.
This one is a direct conceptual counter to planned obsolescence. It's all about maximizing a product's durability and extending its use phase through things like maintenance, repairs, upgrades, and remanufacturing.
So instead of trying to sell me a new phone every 2 years, you're actually incentivized to help me keep the one I have for longer.
That's the strategic shift. Companies generate new revenue through premium repair programs or long-term maintenance contracts. They can charge a premium for that durability, and that fosters huge customer loyalty and strengthens their brand.
Right.
Think about heavy equipment manufacturers. A lot of their profit is now tied to service contracts and the ability to remanufacture old engines, not just selling new ones.
That covers durability. Moving on to usage, we have the fourth model, sharing models. This seems focused on getting the most out of every asset that's already out there.
Yes, the core mechanism is just allowing multiple users to access the same product. So individual ownership is replaced by shared access, renting, or borrowing.
And this works best for products that are often underused. I mean, there are so many of those in our lives, like that power drill you use once a year or a car that's parked 95% of the time.
Exactly. By maximizing the utility of existing assets, sharing models drastically reduce the need for excessive new production and all the waste that comes with it. It also sort of promotes a behavioral shift toward more sustainable consumption.
I imagine consumer behavior is a huge sticking point here, though. How do you convince someone to rent something they feel they might need on a whim rather than just owning it for convenience?
That is the biggest hurdle. You have to overcome the psychological value we attach to ownership, that immediate access it guarantees, and the cultural bias against sharing. These models rely so heavily on trust and ease of access.
If it's too complicated, people will just go back to owning.
Immediately, yeah. Which brings us to our final model, and I think we both agree this one is the most structurally transformative. Product service system models, or PSS.
This is where the financial incentives and the sustainability goals just align perfectly.
Absolutely. This model fundamentally changes the transaction itself. You're selling the function or the service that the product delivers, not the product itself.
So customers pay for access through a lease or a subscription or a pay-per-use arrangement.
Yes. And the genius of this model is the profound incentive shift it creates. The company keeps ownership of the product. They are fully responsible for maintenance, repairs, and its eventual end of life.
Which flips the entire design brief on its head.
Completely. The company is now inherently motivated to design the most durable, easy to maintain, and energy efficient products possible, because every repair call, every part failure, and every waste recovery cost comes directly out of their profit margin.
So you're paying for illumination, not a light bulb. You're paying for mobility, not a car.
A perfect way to frame it. And the insights are quantifiable. For example, Michelin found that by switching to leasing tires for major truck fleets, selling mileage instead of tires, they reduced rubber consumption by almost 20%.
Because it was in their interest to engineer tires that lasted longer.
Exactly. It creates these long-term customer relationships and predictable recurring revenue streams.
But retaining ownership must introduce a huge inventory risk, especially for rapidly evolving technology. How do companies handle the obsolescence risk when they're on the hook for a product 10 years from now.
That is the core challenge for PSS. They mitigate it mainly through standardization and modularity. So the core physical structure, say the body of an industrial printer, might be designed to last 20 years, but the internal tech components are designed to be swapped out every 2.
Oh, okay.
They have to invest heavily in sophisticated reverse logistics and inventory management to track all their assets. It's costly, but it's essential for the model to work.
That's a huge shift from just selling a box and washing your hands of it. So we've outlined 5 strategic options: circular supply, resource recovery, product life extension, sharing, and PSS. Let's evaluate the high-level benefits of adopting these.
Well, the environmental advantages are obvious: a significant reduction of waste, lower carbon emissions, and less demand for resource extraction. But strategically, CBMs are vital for long-term business resilience because they decouple growth from finite resource consumption.
And what are the direct financial advantages for the corporation?
Beyond the supply chain stability we talked about, adopting CBMs really enhances a company's image. And this isn't just fluffy PR. This translates directly to investor confidence.
Right. CSR is now viewed as risk mitigation.
Exactly. It makes companies more attractive to capital. Plus, they attract and retain skilled employees who want to work for a company with a purpose. And then, over the long run, you unlock cost savings through efficiency and resource recovery.
Okay, but transitioning away from centuries of take-make waste has got to be difficult. What are the major limitations and challenges companies are facing?
The first and biggest hurdle is the difficulty and the short-term cost of the transition. We are talking about a fundamental restructuring.
It's not a simple bolt-on.
No, it's a total operational pivot. It demands significant upfront investment in new tech, complete redesigns of the supply chain, creating these complex reverse logistics networks, and extensive retraining for staff.
And as we touched on earlier, consumer behavior can stop these efforts dead in their tracks.
Absolutely. The inertia is immense. You have active resistance from consumers who just prefer the convenience of ownership over sharing. There's an unwillingness to absorb a potentially higher upfront cost for a durable or sustainable product.
And there's skepticism about refurbished or remanufactured goods.
A deep, deep skepticism, a bias we really need to overcome.
We also noted that these models can actually work against one of the key drivers of the modern economy, economies of scale.
That's a core structural challenge. If your focus shifts from mass, disposable output to durability and maintenance, production runs can become smaller, more specialized, requiring highly skilled labor instead of standardized processes.
Which can increase the unit cost, even if the life cycle cost is lower.
Precisely. And finally, infrastructure remains the big external barrier.
The ecosystem around the company.
Indeed. A company can only be as circular as the ecosystem allows. Implementing these models is incredibly difficult without the right external support. Functioning national recycling systems, accessible repair networks, and supportive government incentives and regulations. Without that backbone, a company's ability to close its own loops is severely limited.
So that brings us to our synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Circular business models are clearly essential for moving us from an extractive economy to one that is regenerative and resilient. But as we've seen, the shift is far from easy. It requires a strategic overhaul, major investment, and critical customer buy-in.
And this raises an important question for you, the listener, to mull over, which builds directly on those challenges. Considering the overwhelming need for supportive infrastructure and incentives, so think about a country lacking government-mandated recycling or robust repair networks. Which of the 5 models we discussed today, circular supply, resource recovery, product life extension, sharing, or product service systems, do you think is the absolute hardest to implement successfully? Think about which model is most crippled by that lack of external support.
A great question to take with you as you assess your own industry's path to circularity. Thanks for tuning in.